Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Any commercial advertising you may hear in this program is of the sole discretion and benefit of the host of this program you are listening to. Revolution Radio does not endorse any commercial products, nor does it accept monetary compensation for on-air advertising of commercial products, nor will it ever. We are and shall remain 100% listener supported. Any product advertising on this program are considered used at higher risk, and Revolution Radio shall not be held liable for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host here on The Raw Deal on Revolution Radio this 20th day of November, where I'm very pleased to feature as my guest Nick Kohlerstrom, my dear colleague from the UK, who's done simply brilliant work on a wide range of issues, including conspiracy, has the best book on the London 7-7 subway attack. He has an absolutely fabulous collection exposing 13 false flag attacks in the UK and in Europe. He also has a book on the life and death of Paul McCartney that I regard as simply excellent. He has a shattering book about breaking the spell regarding the Holocaust, and in my opinion is the definitive book on what really happened in World War II. And if you haven't checked it out, you're amiss, because you got to understand, this has been the source of Israeli Zionist Jewish power, a Western sense of guilt over the Holocaust. But the damn thing was all fabrication. It was all made up. There weren't any gas chambers. Nobody died from being put to death in a gas chamber. The International Committee of the Red Cross was keeping copious records on the age, the sex, the ethnicity, the religion, and the cause of death of all the inmates in all the camps. And they discovered in 1993, they did a recalibration and found a total 296,081 had died from all causes together, none of whom died from being put to death in a gas chamber. And Nick, you had the benefit of the British death books. Why don't you tell our audience just a word or two about that? Because, I mean, the British had cracked the code, the German code, and they had copies of all these meticulous records. The Germans were so methodical. Nick, pick it up, my friend.
All right. Well, it's a bit of a surprise, Jim. It's good to be back here again, and thanks for the wonderful appreciation of those my humble endeavours. The death books, I just went to the British Library and got these, which Gorbachev released in 1990s, it was all in Polish, of course, but there was a chapter in English with the statistics, and me and a friend copied them all out and produced some nice graphs, and they showed very clearly, as you say, all the causes of death, something around about 70,000 died in Auschwitz altogether. Those are the most immediate possible record which the Soviets got, the Russians got after they liberated Auschwitz. Then coming on to what was found, I went to what's called the National Archives in Kew, that's in the west of London, and they had these decrypts, which the British had been eavesdropping on the German labour camps for 13 months, and they used this top Bletchley Park Enigma code to decrypt the German codes. And we all hear about how they managed to find out where the German submarines were, but surely much more interesting is that they were overhearing for 13 months the day-to-day radio chatter from the German labor camps. And this was released in the mid-90s. And I just copied them out. I found them quite awesome. It was thrilling to read these top secret. After a 50-year moratorium, they were released, and there they were. And no one else had dared to publish them because they showed no trace of any hoax, and Jews being treated in a perfectly respectful manner. You know, they were going to a labor camp and then they were leaving, being sent somewhere else. And it also had really good monthly totals, a certain number of people are coming and going from each camp, which you could integrate very well with other statistics. So, you know, my book contained this amazing scoop. I didn't quite realize at the time what a scoop it was, of having these decrypts from German labor camps. Showing Auschwitz, for example, all the different types of industry going on there, different types of hard work, that's a hard-working labor camp, and how the inmates, it's a very multicultural place, different, you know, Poles, Russians, Germans, Jews, had to get on together and knock about, get on together, and I found it very fascinating. So my book, obviously that was deeply shocking. My book had to be banned and my publisher has been destroyed, more or less completely destroyed. And you can only get the book, Breaking the Spell, now as a PDF. You can get it downloaded as a PDF. I hope it'll be possible to reprint it again in the not too distant future. But, you know, things being what they are, nobody will touch it at the moment.
But it's fascinating, Nick. It's fascinating, Nick, how people are afraid of the truth. Or really, actually, it's... The Zionists who are suppressing it because it's going to destroy the myth that has been the source of their political power and influence, even in the founding of Israel.
Yeah, and I just mentioned what you referred to, the Allison Archive, so-called. For half a century, it's been the Red Cross Center, a place in the north of Germany. They've got all, you know, Holocaust survivor records. They all went there. And in the late 1980s of the last century, they released total numbers of inmates from each, of deaths from each camp. And there's three different occasions on which they released those totals. And as you said, about 290,000 in total. And you then have to decide what proportion of those you think were Jews. You know, that is the most reliable total figure of deaths in the German labor camps.
But, yes.
I don't see anything very mysterious about it. It totally well agrees with what we get from other sources. So I think my book has got some very sound arithmetic in it about how many people died in the German labor camps.
Nick, and the photographs you have, for example, I liked it so much. I put it on the back cover of my book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. The British soccer team at Auschwitz. What, you didn't know there was a British soccer team at Auschwitz? Or the photographs of the little kids who were born in the camps, hundreds, maybe even 1,000 children. And last time I checked, Nick, that took about 9 months of gestation. And you got these hundreds of little kids. So how does that reconcile? Yeah. Well, emptying people out of boxcars, stripping them naked, yeah, putting them into gas chambers and killing them outright. I mean, the whole thing is absurd. In Auschwitz, yeah, in the floor plan, they not only have a hospital with OBGYN, they even have a woodworking shot, a symphony hall, and get this, a brothel. A brothel.
Yeah, and they have some sort of rudimentary currency. I think you have to save up to pay for the brothel, you know. Or maybe it's rewarded. I think Himmler, it was some sort of reward, I think, that brothel, the stuff you've done. I can't quite remember. But I tell you, the thing that boggled people's minds more than any of the things you mentioned was a swimming pool. And people associated with me, I was ridiculed for claiming there was a swimming pool in Auschwitz, as if it was something I'd somehow dreamed up, you know.
Well, of course not. It's shown right on the map. On the map of the layout of Auschwitz, there's a swimming pool. I've seen photographs of a swimming pool. Why would anyone have any doubt, Nick? Why would that be startling?
Well, I assure you that did. And it was used to ridicule me quite a lot, showing how deranged I was. Slamming those,
of all the persons I've known who might be deranged, you are about as exceptional as any in not falling in that category, my friend. And I've known a lot of people with a lot of unusual ideas, But your research, Nick, again and again, has proven to be completely sound. They can't create an encyclopedia of astronomers and have you author the piece on Sir Isaac Newton, the greatest figure in the history of astronomy and physics, without recognizing your authoritative stance as a historian of science, Nick, for which I commend you. You have done such good work.
Well, okay, thanks, Jim. But my career as a science historian more is terminated once I come out with the stuff we've just been talking about.
Yeah.
It's as if anything I did in the history of science has just vanished in the previous life.
Yeah, it's like mine on Sandy Hook thing. Now, I've lost all kinds of friends and associates, colleagues, even family members who are, you know, befuddled. They think that I've lost my way when I have the FEMA manual. We now have we have it on the record for the Connecticut FEMA. They even sent out a map how to get down there for the drill, their exercise.
We have photographs.
We have photographs from inside the school in the Connecticut State Police showing in a hallway where there's supposed to be two bodies and pools of blood, no bodies, no pools of blood, inside a classroom where there's supposed to be all kinds of kid bodies. No bodies, no blood, but no desks, no chairs, no teacher desk. Furniture pushed up against a wall, proving not only that there was no mass murder, that the school wasn't even open, Nick.
Right. Well, you're absolutely correct, but it was just a drill and nobody died. I think you've shown that beyond a reasonable doubt. I think it's a great shame that Alex Jones backed out on that one. He should have just quoted you and stuck to his guns.
You know, I tried repeatedly to intervene on his behalf, Nick, but he wouldn't have it. He even said during a video interview, a deposition in Connecticut, he never read Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. How can a prominent guy like that take a stand without reading the only objective scientific study ever done on the event? My God.
You know, it's terribly important for every informed, well-educated person in today's world to understand the difference between the state fabricated events where people do really die and those where they don't. And those where they don't are done with actors and dummies and fake identities, which is very much, as you discovered, Sandy Hook.
Yes. Well, as I explained in my answer to the complaint, Nick, I did not believe there was a real Leonard Posner, that he's a legal fiction, that his real name is Reuben Vabner, and that I was being sued over a death certificate for his purported son, Noah, where I proved that Noah, in terms of photographs, was also a fiction made out of photographs of Michael Vabner, Reuben Vabner's older son, when he was a child. We have that in spades, Nick. And the court in Wisconsin just set that all aside, not to mention two forensic document expert substantiation of my position. It's outrageous, Nick.
Yeah, well, the alleged killer lad, the nightmare sort of character, Lanza, he was a mock-up character. He didn't exist, did he?
Yes. Yeah, I agree completely.
I think the mother had some sort of real identity, though, although she may not have lived where it was claimed. So people do need to look at to see what is fictional here. And especially subtle. In the whole Sandy Hook story, is where the kids did exist, but they were quite a bit older than it was claimed, weren't they?
Nick, virtually all the families were fabricated. Everyone had phony names. Yeah. I could go through this in great detail.
None of the kids died.
Right. Nobody died. Sandy Hook. And would you believe the judges set aside all my evidence that it wasn't relevant to the authenticity of a death certificate for someone who claimed to die? So how does this work logically, Nick? I'm claiming nobody died at Sandy Hook, and I have a mountain of proof, but he won't let me introduce him on the ground it's irrelevant to the accuracy or truthfulness of the death certificate for someone who allegedly died at Sandy Hook. It says right on the death certificate.
Yeah, okay. But those kids whose photos were shown, they were kind of rewarded, were they not, by turning up sometime later at the Beyonce concert.
No, but you're talking about the Super Bowl.
And they were some years later. That's why they couldn't be immediately identified as being the same kids. They were actually quite a bit older. Have I got that right?
Yes. Well, I mean, look, some parents even use photographs of themselves when they were children to be their dead kid. Others did use photographs of other kids, but the whole thing was every one of them was a fabrication, Nick. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Every one of them was a fabrication.
Yeah. America needs to look at how come enormous amounts of money poured into that Newtown and to create this a drill that just it didn't exactly go live, but it just acquired a bit too much reality.
Well, get this, Nick. You and I haven't discussed it, but it's now been not quite a year, I think. I was in contact with two of the participants in the drill. One, Margaret Alice Cottle was cast as Emily Parker, and Victoria Aurelia, who was cast as Vicky Soto, a dead teacher. I was in contact with them. They explained to me, actually, it wasn't even an elementary school. It was a special needs school, and that it had actually closed in 2006. And they made the astute point that, have you ever heard of an elementary school without a playground? That school has no playground, Nick. I mean, it's just absurd. Yeah. And that Eric Holder came down in 2006 and offered the community $140 million if they would do this drill. They even had auditions for the drill, Nick. They signed non-disclosure agreements.
What was the motive? Was it gun control? That's what people say.
Gun control. Something, too. To promote what?
So it backfired totally, didn't it? Gun sales, actually.
Right, that's right. Right, more and more gun sales. Nick, we can talk about this at length. Actually, we already have. Let me bring us up to date with some developments in terms of what's going on in Israel and with Hamas. Iran tells Hamas it will not enter the war. The Supreme Leader has explained. Hezbollah says it had no idea that Hamas attack was going to take place. They have, however, been destroying buildings. Here's one. The IDF blowing up in a Hamas government building in Gaza. They're being very effective at destroying the buildings, Nick. It's really something. Meanwhile, the Russian ambassador to Israel has declared that the Middle East conflict, the prospect of expanding is very high, that it's very important that not happen. Nick, just your thoughts about those couple of developments.
Well, the U.S. has got an enormously powerful fleet around the Red Sea and the East Mediterranean, as it were, a nuclear-armed submarine and four of the largest aircraft carriers. All as if they're intending to attack Iran. And normally, if that immense amount of firepower is assembled, you can't easily take it home again without using it. That is the nightmare that the world is now in. But Biden hasn't really got a policy except kind of starting wars and threatening wars. And I think that's what's happening now. America doesn't really have a coherent aim, what it wants to do here. It generally backs Israel for its unlimited expansion and to exterminate the... Yeah. Israel clearly has...
The people aren't supporting Israel, but the government is all in. It's outrageous, Nick. Let me add a few more developments here as we continue our conversation. The shift in focus from Ukraine to the Middle East raises the prospect of a world war, Paul Craig Roberts astutely observes. Turkey's president has said to Israel, your end is nigh. Your nuclear bombs don't matter. Here he is, Nick. This is really significant. Yeah. Hey, Israel, you have
it. It's great that he's come out and supporting the Palestinians.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Here's what he's saying in Turkish, so I'll give the English. Hey, Israel, you have an atomic bomb, a nuclear bomb, and you're making threats with this. We know this. Here he is.
Israel, sende atom bombası, nükleer bomba var. Ve bununla tehdit ediyorsun.
Yeah.
Bunları biz biliyoruz.
Yeah.
He says, and your end is near.
Awesome.
You can have as many nuclear bombs as you want. You can have whatever you want, but you're on your way out.
Yeah. I mean, just consider why you have to say that. Think how many Islamic nations have been bombed by America this century.
Oh, right? I know.
The sense of rage amongst Muslims in Turkey is such that Erdogan has to take a position like this. But if America is going to start attacking Iran, Turkey will have to, I think it will have to respond. I think there will be too much fury amongst the population if they don't.
Well, I've been to Iran. I was in Iran in 2014 for an international conference. Iran is the greatest peace-loving nation in the world. Iran has not launched a war of aggression against any other state since 1775, Nick. How astonishing.
I do agree, yeah. I'm very jealous of you having been to Iran recently. I would love to go, but it's almost impossible for an English person now for obvious reasons.
Yes.
But as you say, they are a peace-loving nation that has a reputation of not ever starting wars.
Yes.
But they're under immense pressure now. Israel, well, Jim, let's just go over, in case any listeners don't remember this, what Gaza actually is, okay?
Sure.
Israel has had an official policy, normal policy, of wiping out Palestinian villages so that the people are exterminated, they arrive, they blow up the homes, the men and women are killed. Sorry, the men and children and sons are killed. The women and children are then captured and taken off to Gaza. So the end result of wiping out village after village after village is that you get a lot of very young people, just women and children, in this open-air prison camp, Gaza. And then after that, they've enjoyed dropping phosphorus munitions on Gaza, totally prohibited. And they've been doing that again recently. So it's a small area by the coastline. And they're now going for a complete evacuation of that area, trying to either exterminate the people in Gaza or getting drive into Egypt. And they've already given out contracts for the apparently it's oil and gas found there. Israel's really selling contracts for that.
So, Nick, how can that be legal? It doesn't belong to Israel. It belongs to Gaza, the Palestinian. How can he be giving out these leases? It appears to me that it's totally fraudulent. But, of course,
he expects to
annihilate Gaza. He's going to annex so they can have all that gas and oil and build a Ben-Gurion canal.
Yeah. Well, Israel just confident and get away with it. They think their God is on their side and that they want the Old Testament keeps telling to wipe out your neighbors, unbelievers, destroy neighboring tribes, subjugate them, and that's what they're doing now. It's the most evident, obvious genocide in our lifetime. I would say what's happening now for Palestinian people,
and we can watch it on television, Nick.
Yeah. Let's bear in mind these are Semites, the people being wiped out. So this is an anti-Semitic operation. And the people in Israel who come from Europe, European Ashkenazi Khazars, are not Semitic at all.
That's right.
So this is an anti-Semitic operation.
100%.
Misuse language.
Yeah. You're so right, Nick. I love it. Let me add a few more. So, of course, Israel accuses Turkey of supporting terrorism when Israel is a terrorist state. Erdogan argued Israel had been continuously committing war crimes in the last 40 days, deliberately targeting hospitals, streets, and mosques, schools, and churches. He's carrying out the most heinous attack against women and children in all of history and threatening people with nuclear arms. I think the argument is very one-sided. We're also getting more and more reports that the Israelis ran up the tally on October 7th that an Israeli helicopter shot up the concert.
Yeah, right. So, more and more is coming out about
right. They use these Apache. They use Apache attack helicopters. We provided them to slaughter many so they could run up the number. Here's nice. Yeah. Get this. Israel's style of public relation when they're accused of a war crime. They say, first, we haven't heard reports of deaths, but we'll check into it. When they're exposed, they say, people were killed, but by a faulty Palestinian rocket or bomb. Oh, when that's exposed, okay, we killed them, but they were terrorists. When that's confirmed, they say, okay, but they were civilians. but they were being used as human shields. When that's exposed, okay, there were no fighters in the area, so it was our mistake, but we killed civilians by accident. They do it on purpose. When that's exposed, they say, okay, we kill far more civilians than they do on purpose, but look how terrible other countries are. And when that's exposed, why are you still talking about Israel? Are you some kind of anti-Semite? Nick, I think that captures it.
Well, within America, we need to focus on these 50 million Christians, which we hear about. I read the, was it the Gideon's Bible, that advises them to support Israel.
Schoenfeld Bible.
All right, yeah. Must fervent support from Israel comes from these people, and they need to appreciate that what Israel's doing is not God's work. Supporting Israel will not make any good return, maybe rather the contrary. And this is a terror state. Israel is a terror state. It has no nationally recognized legitimate borders. The borders that were given by the United Nations in 1948 were completely unreal and impossible. They were just kind of traced around the outside of Palestine, leaving the whole of the middle part to the Palestinians.
Nick, let me squeeze this in. There was a huge pro-Palestinian rally in Washington, D.C. at the National Mall. Here they're reporting about it.
As Gabriela Primus explains, this is the largest pro-Israel rally in the nation's history.
Yeah.
But get this, Nick. A pro-Israel group was paying students $250 a box apiece to attend the rally. I mean, how absurd is this? Israel on Campus Coalition gave micro grants for people to attend yesterday's March for Israel. How insulting is this?
I urge all the 50 million Christians who are amongst those you just alluding to, are fervently supporting Israel, to get the Shlomo Sand book, Defense of the Jewish People, which clearly shows that the descendants of Judea in Bible times are the Palestinians. Okay?
Nick, we break. We'll turn with Nick Cole from Mike.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Nick, I just want to make a couple points before we turn to your new book on Shakespeare, which I think everyone will find a relief from the mass killing, the slaughter, the mayhem taking place in both Ukraine and in Israel today. Here we have the new Speaker of the House of Representatives. Calls for a ceasefire are outrageous. This is at that rally in Washington, D.C., where they were paid to attend, prompting the crowd to chant, no ceasefire, no ceasefire. How outrageous is that? Meanwhile, public support for Israel has plummeted to just 32%, where the majority back a ceasefire. Unbelievable. Public support is eroding. Most Americans think Israel should call a ceasefire to a conflict that ballooned into a humanitarian crisis. Some 32% on a two-day opinion poll said U.S. should support Israel when asked the role taken in the fighting, down from 41% who said they should back Israel in a poll on the October 12th and 13th. The share saying U.S. should be a neutral mediator rose to 39% from 27%. 4% said the U.S. should support Palestinians. Everyone should support Palestinians. I mean, this is absurd. 15% said they shouldn't be. Here, really, I wanted to share finally, Nick, you know, just to show how worldwide protests.
I was on it. Anyway, here are some pro-Hamas protests in London, because this is the big Saturday thing they're doing in London now.
I love it, Nick. I love it.
Right, you get it. It's a lot of river to the sea. It's end the 75-year occupation, which is ironic because they're in London. And of course, if we were to end the 75-year occupation, we would have to bring back the British Empire. I don't know that any of them want that. I don't know that the average Brit wants it, much less the terrorist sympathizers that are out there doing that. But how long can a society hold something like this? Like, I can show you there were plenty of calls for they were talking about how the Nazis should finish the job. Like, trust me, we went through 50 videos of like the actual firing of fireworks at police officers and all that stuff. But you guys get it. The reason I wanted to show you that one is how long can a society hold this position that on every weekend, let's say, or twice?
Nick, let's
go. Listen to this stuff. I mean, I'm shocked that America's won't idiotic commentator like that. I mean, we are demonstrating for a ceasefire and to stop bombing children in Palestine.
Yeah.
I get this. What's this smart ass guy scoffing at it and saying we're sympathizing with terrorists? I mean, this is just Jewish propaganda, disgraceful Jewish propaganda.
Yeah. No, I know, Nick. I know. I'm not a fan of this guy.
Twice a week.
Let me.
Anyway, here it's.
Oh, what happened I got a call that threw me off, Nick. Let me get us back. Keep talking, my friend. Keep talking.
Those are the biggest demonstrations, political demonstrations, since the anti-Iraq war protest. It's happening each Saturday now in the UK.
Yes.
We get scoffed at. The government says we're a hate demonstration, a hate march. And I'm shocked that only 4% of Americans support the Palestinian cause. Why do they... Anyway, I suppose they're misinformed, I think the crux of the matter in this 7th of October event is, as you said, the most a large proportion of the killings in Israel were done by the IDF, the Israeli army. And the reports we heard from Hamas, of people who were captured by Hamas, said they treated them rather well. They just wanted hostages, and they were not randomly shooting people. A whole lot of the huge destruction reported on the 7th of October is, as you indicated, clearly done by very powerful weapons, not the little rifles that the Hamas possessed.
So it's
a fictional account that is given to the
world.
I think it's terribly important to anything to do in Israel, bear in mind their motto, Mossad, by way of deception shall you win war.
Yes. Wage war.
Shall you wage war?
Yeah.
I think the American media are deeply deceived by...
Well, look, I have a panel of 100 execs from CNN. All of them are dual U.S.-Israeli citizens. I got a panel of 100 execs from NBC. All of them are dual U.S.-Israeli citizens. I got another panel from the New York Times. 100 execs. Yeah. All of whom are dual U.S.-Israeli citizens. The Rothschild own the AP and Reuters. So virtually all the news America gets that's not local is filtered through a Zionist lens.
Yeah, this is the main problem in the world now, why America, as it were, always fights on the wrong side of every war, including my country, Britain also, fights on the wrong side of every war to crush national independence and to promote international Rothschild Zionism and banking. Citizens need to rise up and do what they can to object to this and not pay taxes to a central government that does this.
Yes. Yes. Well, Nick, as we know, our idea here is to introduce or talk about your new book, and I'm very, very pleased that you are here to do it. I do have the slides set up for us to proceed. I'm just pulling them up.
Yeah, not easy to switch over. Let me say, I think it's very courageous of Erdogan to speak up, as he has done. Anyway,
I agree, Nick. And listen, Turkey, of course, has a long history in the Middle East, the Ottoman Empire. They used to control Jerusalem and all the lands of Palestine. And Erdogan, I believe, wants to assert a role as a leader of the Arab and Muslim world. And having made these strong statements, Nick, I do not believe he can now back down. Your thoughts?
No. Well, Turkey's been very undermined by these terrible earthquakes. It's had not so long ago. Huge earthquakes.
It turns out the U.S. brings about those earthquakes, and heck, the U.S. is doing that. It's terrible.
You think that the Harp or whatever can do that in Turkey?
Yeah, I suspect. Yeah, they're doing it all over the world. It's outrageous. They're using weather warfare.
That's something we're wondering about. Does the Empire really have that power?
Oh, yeah, they do. They do, Dick. Mark my words. They do.
There's evidence of people leaving Turkey or leaving the embassies just before that earthquake struck.
Sure.
I think there is some evidence of foreknowledge.
They knew it was coming, yes.
Wow. Well, Turkey had said some very controversial things to annoy America just before that earthquake struck. So that greatly weakens and undermines Turkey. Which is the case for obviously any country around there not supporting Israel, like Syria. Syria can't do more because it's so much weakened by American presence and by Israel bombing the country.
I'm just disgusted with the foreign policy of the USA, Nick. It is despicable. As you were saying, we're on the wrong side of all of these wars, all these issues. It's outrageous.
This is a very, very strange business. Let's urge any military or ex-military listening to this that you're in a special position to be able to do something about it. And let's also urge any elderly ladies listening to this that you're in a powerful position because the police don't like arresting women. If you can protest, express your rage, tell the young men not to fight, and tell people not to pay taxes, you're in a strong position now to say what you think America ought to be doing, because they don't like arresting women. especially urge you to speak up.
You know, they've weakened it. They ran a campaign, the Democrats, to defund the police, Nick. They supported all these riots and looting and arson by BLM and Antifa. They weren't arresting anyone. I mean, it's just ridiculous what they've done. And they got George Soros elected DAs in there, not enforcing the crime, shoplifting is run rampant. The more expensive stores are moving out. Wealthier people are relocating because cities are turning into chaos and lawlessness, which means the tax revenue is shrinking for these communities, which means there's less they can do to deal with the problems that are growing by the day. So the revenue is shrinking by the day and their problems are growing. It's a recipe for disaster, but that was the plan.
Yeah, but the military expenditure is going up and up. You know, some expenditure, some estimates are over $1 trillion a year now. That's what I hear now of America total military spending, on including everything, which is, so it just keeps increasing, doesn't it?
Yeah, just lunatic, Nick. Should we now at this point turn to your new book, my friend?
Okay, let's see if we can.
I mean, it's you do so much wonderful work on so many different subjects. Please.
Well, we should have a break, really, but let's try and switch our mind over. Okay, everybody, let's on a more pleasant subject. Something happened 400 years ago, and we're in anniversary year. Okay, anniversary year now, 1623, and we're looking at the question of real identity, of who really was a great playwright, and
the greatest of all playwrights.
Greatest of all playwrights, and how did he have to lose all credit for his plays as a kind of price he had to pay? This genius, what was his inspiration, and he lost all his credit. And 400 years ago, these amazing 36 plays were published, given a credit to somebody who could not read or write. You know, his children couldn't read or write. His parents couldn't read or write. He was sort of country fellow who just lent money and did a bit of sheep farming and stuff. Let's call him Shakespeare, Will Shakespeare, Shakespeare name. He did manage to get himself up to London at one point, and become connected with one of the new theatres on the banks of the Thames, right? Will Shakespeare. Through that connection, they somehow wanted to use his name. And so the very strange synchrony and coincidence. And what I'm saying in this book is that whoever did it was very close to the royalty, the royal family, and a whole lot of issues, the central themes of the Shakespeare plays are the British royal family, the history of the royal family, who has the right to rule this country. That's the core issue. He started off his career, first plays published, about the Wars of the Roses, which were 100 years earlier. So somehow he had the history of England in his family, in his bones, and it's what he wanted to write about. It was precisely because he was so close to royalty that his name could not be used, and also because a whole lot of people in the royal court were, as it were, put into the plays, that it was too politically dangerous. And at that time, Tudor England, Tudor, right? That's Queen Elizabeth. It wasn't done at all for a noble person to write anything. Yeah, if you wrote anything,
I just want to make an aside. They attack people who are conspiracy theorists as though there were no conspiracy. What would Shakespeare have to write about but not for plots against the kings and queens of England? Those were all conspiracies. You can't understand history if you don't understand conspiracies. The whole idea of attacking people who are doing conspiracy research is ill-founded from the beginning and as an impure motivation to try to suppress research into crimes that more often than not lead back to the government. So, of course, the government wants to suppress it.
Right. So all these plots and conspiracies went into the Shakespeare plays, is what you wrote about. So now, an amazing thing that's happening now, 400 years later, we're getting the real identity. You go back, 100 years ago, people thought, oh, maybe it's Francis Bacon. Well, that was an old theory. Bacon was an immensely learned character, but he didn't like poetry at all. No romantic soul. He wrote an enormous amount of stuff, but it was practical, materialistic kind of philosophy about science and that, and law. So he helped publish the plays. He was around when the plays were published, let me say, he knew the authors. It could have been a group of authors, more than one, because there's an amazing amount and huge number of different words. Here's Ben Jonson. Ben Jonson has a central role in unleashing the myth of this Will Shakespeare as if he'd written the plays. That picture you see down there, horrible picture, famous picture, is a totally composite image. It's not a real character at all. You can see his face. His head is not really on his shoulders, okay? That's kind of giveaway. So it's not a picture of anyone. It's just a composite image of a guy who never existed. There never was a playwright called William Shakespeare, and there never was a playwright who lived in Stratford-on-Avon, okay?
So the man who had the name Will Shakespeare could not have written the play because he was illiterate, and the ones who wrote the play were...
Let's call him Shakespeare. That's a traditional English name.
Yeah, Shakespeare.
Otherwise we'll get too confused.
Sure.
The guy in Stratford, Will Shakespeare, didn't write a thing, and at his death, nobody took any notice, he earned a bit of money, and his most criminal things he's involved in, police records of stuff he was up to. He's not a very savoury character. He sued people for not paying back loans. He somehow got the credit. And so every English department in this country and in America has got it completely wrong. That guy did not write a thing. The main favourite character now is Edward de Vere, who was the very distinguished Earl. He was the most distinguished Earl in the country, and very close to the Queen of England. He would have grown up. Well, let's have a look at what you're showing here. 1593. This is the first appearance of the name Shakespeare, and it's a poem, it's a big, heavy, sort of erotic type poem, dedicated to the Earl of Southampton. There's three people who get Shakespeare material dedicated to them, right? This is one, the poems, and then the plays are dedicated to other people, Herberts, and those three men who get dedications are all married or engaged to daughters of Edward de Vere. That's very much a clue to the authorship, okay? Edward de Vere had three daughters, and they all married people to whom plays were dedicated, married or engaged to people. So that's part of the story of how the plays were all collected together and published well after the main characters were dead.
Here's a wise
comment by Alexander Wall. All references to Shakespeare are reference to a pseudonym, somebody who didn't exist. They're not allusions to a real living writer. So that's a fundamental statement. And it was very much in fashion to use pseudonyms. This is the Minerva shaking her spear. So it was a literary illusion that somebody was... It's an inspiration, the idea of inspiration, of Minerva shaking her spear. That was the kind of thing that it meant, right? And the plays appeared with a hyphen. You can see a hyphen here, shake hyphen spear. That's clearly indicating that it's a nom de plume, not a real person. Everyone would have taken it that way. Here's where the name first begins, right at the end of the 16th century, shows how it's been acted by various people, and this fellow puts his name to it. I think there's a lot of research coming out that might have been various authors, but there was one main genius, Edward de Vere, who was greatly admired and respected as a poet, someone commented on writing plays. But there is a deep, awesome mystery by the way the plays appeared in the theatre companies, they would have a play that they would never say Shakespeare gave this play. When they gave the name of the play, they would not give the name Shakespeare. It's not written down or recorded in the theatre books, and nobody's on record of getting paid for those plays. So when theatre company got a play called the name of Shakespeare, or was the author, it meant don't ask any questions, okay? Somebody high up has given you this play, and if you like it, play it, but don't ask any questions. Okay, Edward de Vere was given £1,000 a year by Queen Elizabeth, which was a lot in those days, in the 1580s, and he could set up a big kind of house for Fisher's Folly, where a whole lot of people were writing, churning out plays, and this was a terrifically exciting thing in that day and age, because, you know, there were no newspapers or anything, and the whole traditional England religion had been abolished by Henry VIII, the whole Catholic Church had been banned, whole lot of Catholic traditions of England had been abolished, and what you're allowed to say, religion kept switching over with different monarchs, what you're allowed to say was quite restricted. And so players would have coded information about what was going on in the country, and people would flock to hear them. A playwright could easily be arrested or tortured, like Marlowe was threatened with death, Christopher Marlowe, because he was accused of atheism. So plays were very popular, but at the same time, it was very dangerous for someone, whoever the author was, which I think is why a pseudonym was used, okay? So everyone had known that some sort of top person around the royal family, or rather around royalty, was producing these, and you just don't ask any questions. And the plays obviously focus on kings and nobles, and they don't have so much about ordinary people. Okay, the main focus is always the right to rule this country. For example, the plays have reference to falconry, which is something that only the kings and top upper crust did. Whole lot of terms and language about falconry, and loads of it in Shakespeare. So he was obviously very familiar with this. Here, we're looking at the Rose Theatre manager keeping his plays in diary. And these are the earliest appearances of plays, or very early appearances, that would later be published as Shakespeare plays. Okay? So we may take it that these are early versions of the plays, but it doesn't have that name on them. They're kind of anonymous, aren't they? Right. Here's a great book I recommend by John Michel, who wrote Shakespeare, but the trouble is it's totally agnostic. It reviews all the different characters, but doesn't have any view about who the real author was. So I found that quite annoying, actually. That's what stimulated me to do this little book. But here's a wise comment from him that the name meant you just take the play and don't ask any questions. Okay. And that's another fake image you see there, a fake image of the bard holding a quill pen. That's not a real person at all. Okay. You might find this helpful when the various characters die off. You can see, for example, Christopher Marlowe dies off really too early, early 1590s, and a whole lot of plays appear after that time. De Vere, 1604, that's the end of the Elizabethan era. And the great flow of Shakespeare plays stops at 1604, but you do get one or two more, like The Tempest, great plays. It's speculated that there might have been a different author after De Vere has passed away. But 1580s is when a great manufacturing of these plays would have taken place, and the earliest versions of the plays, which later got polished up and finalised around 1590. The Earl of Derby, he's another candidate, but William Stanley he's called. He's got the advantage of having the right initials, WS. He does live on a lot longer, and he very likely made some of the changes or maybe wrote the last plays, The Tempest. These two were close together. They knew each other, and they would have collaborated together. Okay. Okay, the guy called Shakespeare, in Stratford, died 1616, and he probably never realised the huge credit he was going to get from using his name, you know. Francis Bacon was totally involved in publishing the plays, him and Ben Jonson, so he would have had a lot to do with getting the plays together so they look all right and can be put into print. The great mystery of Shakespeare plays is there's no draft versions at all. You've got nothing in any handwriting. You've got these final, you've got these published plays, 1623, and that's it. Everyone keeps hoping we'll find a manuscript, but they're not there. And that would have been partly because of the it was simplistically dangerous. I mean, who knows what? Right. Okay. It's fascinating to look at the play Hamlet and how it reflects the life of Edward de Vere. This is one of the strongest things that ties up the life of Edward de Vere with the plays. It's everyone's favourite Shakespeare play. It came out 1603, it came out and then published. And then the king, this is the new King James, sends an ambassador over to Denmark. There's this palace, Elsinore, where Hamlet's story is located, right? He sends an ambassador over to Elsinore and a whole lot of details, geographical details and corrections he comes back with. And the 1604, that's when the final version of Hamlet appears.
Thanks. Stand by, we'll be right back after this break.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs. But there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
That the Capitol will ever treat us fairly. You are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence. At the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming.
And it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates. You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, I'm just ecstatic to have you here, Nick, my friend. I'm just absolutely delighted. And clearly, you're suggesting William DeVries is the most likely candidate, though I await your further confirmation or denial thereof. But it's fascinating, everything you're presenting. We had, of course, this life overlap. Very, very interesting. And I notice if you look at DeVries, he would have been old enough, I think, to start, you know, producing the plays that would be attributed to Shakespeare, or really the anonymous plays that were attributed to no one, with a certain delay, Nick, you know, in others, in terms of the point at which it gets around to being produced. I certainly like all that. And here...
Yeah, well, let's come on to the Hamlet story.
Yes.
Okay? Now, you get, from there, mind you, the story is Hamlet's engaged to Ophelia, who's the daughter of Polonius, who is the queen's intelligencer, or what you call home secretary or whatever. And he is getting somehow switched off or fed up with Ophelia. And also Hamlet, his father has died and been killed, and he doesn't like the replacement. Okay, Edward de Vere was obliged to marry Anne Cecil, who he didn't really like. And she was the daughter of the Queen's intelligencer, William Cecil. So there's a quite similar structure there. And Edward Vere's father died young, and he was in fact brought up by Robert Cecil, the son of William Cecil. So I suggest he puts that all in the plays. There's a very famous bit where Polonius gives advice to his son Laertes, who's going to Paris, you know, neither a borrower nor a lender be, above all to ourself be true, and all sort of helpful advice about life, and how to look after your friends and so on. And it's generally acknowledged that that is a copy of what was written by William Cecil, which was later on it was published, Maxims for his son Robert, who also happened to be going to Paris. So, whole advice about how to live a life by the Queen's intelligencer, a wise intelligencer, William Cecil, that then gets an echo in what Polonius says to his son. Strong analogy is here being made. Hamlet appears, he's a prince, who's in charge of a troop of players, and he starts giving them advice about how to act. And just the same with Edward de Vere, as an aristocrat, he, like his father before him, were in charge of a troop of players and would have been very concerned with the proper way for them to act. So as a top aristocrat in 17th in England, he could feel a bit similar to Hamlet, the Prince of Denmark. And there's also a twist that the Hamlet ship is in the play, is boarded by pirates, and he's left naked on the shore. And the same shocking thing happened to Edward de Vere on his way back to England from France, although in the Hamlet play, it's Denmark. So there's a whole lot of personal stuff in the play Hamlet, and it's the last play to be published, as it were, just slightly after Edward de Vere dies. You get the Hamlet play appearing, and Hamlet says his dying cry, says that, you know, the rest is silence, and he urges Horatio to report his case aright, and people feel that that is Edward de Vere speaking about the way his whole name and reputation has been lost, that he's utterly lost the credit for his great masterpieces. There's some scandal in his love life, which is going on. That's partly why he can't be given the credit for the plays, and he dies. So he dies very much without having got the credit. Although there's a whole lot of poets and artists around who do admire Edward de Vere and do praise him, but they have to do so in a fairly covert manner, without saying that he's written the plays.
Because it was so personal, is it possible Hamlet was held back until the end of his life to be published perhaps only posthumously?
Yeah. I think it is. It's a terrible tragic play. Nearly everyone dies in it. So it's appropriate for the end of his life. Some people reckon that Edward de Vere didn't actually die in 1604 because he was in financial trouble and he arranged his death because there was no funeral and no will and no gravestone.
Sort of an alternative to bankruptcy.
Yeah. And then in 1605, the year after, the play King Lear appears, which is where a king has given away all his property to his three daughters and also his castle. Edward de Vere had a great castle called Headingham Castle, and his daughters were kind of managing it. So the tragedy of King Lear comes from the king having to be dependent on his three daughters, who don't like him and are quite annoyed at him. So Edward de Vere, after his alleged death, may have found himself very dependent on the three daughters in a way he didn't quite like.
What is studying Elsinore Castle? Wow. That's
right.
That's fantastic, Nick.
Yeah, well, you can go and visit it today. It's done up, and they have the Hamlet. They do Hamlet tours of Elsinore Castle, you know, they've preserved it very well. So that's a nice historic landmark, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, these in red, plays in red, are plays which were given as the name. The name was given as William Shakespeare. You see, there's about seven or eight of them. And other ones are anonymous. And there's ones in blue where he just says he corrected them, augmented them. So I think a lot of the plays would have been made by various people who didn't put their name to them. And also by the actors. The actors would have been given roles and they would knock them about, you know, in performances. At the end of the time, after they'd done the play a few times, somebody would write out the script. So I think the actors had a lot of a creative role in doing this. Let's be aware that a whole lot of Shakespeare plays appear without his name on them. It's right at the end from, it's 1598 onwards that the name Shakespeare starts to appear. So it was a very much a collective process the plays appeared, and that's shown by the possibly large number of words in the Shakespeare plays, some like 20,000, much too many different words for one playwright to use. You know, normally a playwright would have, I don't know, 9,000 words or something.
So Nick, you find that a persuasive argument that it was collaboration in the production of the plays?
Definitely, yeah. There was various people knocking about. I mean, De Vere might have had a final master touch in tweaking them and finishing them off. And also he was in charge. Don't forget, he was paid a lot of money to help get a bunch of playwrights to knock these out as propaganda. They were propaganda for the Tudor crown, but you couldn't control De Vere. Other times he would say something that the crown didn't like. But a whole lot of people put together writing these plays, and it was creating a whole new culture in England. This is the Renaissance culture, and all the old plays, only a couple of decades earlier, used to be church mystery plays about Adam and Eve and the flood, you know. So that had all been abolished. All the Catholic culture had suddenly been abolished, and this was a new culture appearing. It was humanistic, and it wasn't so focused primarily on religion, okay? All the terrible strife and conflict between Protestant and Catholics. Yeah. What you got?
The plays are so genius. I mean, they just reek with genius. I mean, literary plot, style, character is just, yeah, it's breathtaking. There's never been a literary equivalent to Shakespeare's play. It's just mind-boggling, the quality of this work.
Yeah, partly there's optimism. Because the defeat of the Spanish Armada, was it 1588? The wind blew and the mightiest navy in the world, Spanish Armada, was scattered, and Drake could take and others could take the credit for beating the Spanish Armada. They felt we've got God on our side here, and so there's a terrific sense of national optimism and adoration of the Queen of England, who's kind of mythic character, and that is the context in which you see this golden age of English poetry and literary style. So a whole lot of people would have been knocking plays together and putting them out, and people loved hearing them. And it's a new culture. And a whole lot of the what Shakespeare did, he brought the glory of the Italian Renaissance over to England, right? De Vere was in Italy for many years, and he totally soaked up Italian culture. And there's loads, about at least 10 plays of Shakespeare, all about Italy, you know, the Merchant of Venice and Romeo and Juliet and so on. And they have a whole lot of detail of Italy, Italian culture, Italian places. Somebody knew Italy very well.
Nick, that is so powerful. That is so substantial. That is so significant. You're nailing this, my friend. You are just nailing this. I love it.
Right. Well, that's important. He came back. He was full of Italian ways and Italian culture, so he brought that back to England in the plays. There's only one English kind of common English play. I forget which, about ordinary people in England. Whereas there's loads of them from Italy, so that is one thing that gives a focus on his identity. That he was able to bring these Italian manners and Italian ways into all these plays. Yeah.
Fascinating, Nick. Fascinating. Then we have the sonnets.
Right. Well, these were alluded to. Ever-living poet, which kind of means that he's dead. They're very personal. Very personal. But they do describe, I think the various bits allude to De Vere's life. He had a marriage that wasn't happy at all. He was rather doubtful about whether the first child was really his. But she did give him three daughters. Then he had a very passionate, tempestuous affair, what's called the Dark Lady. Again, this was a lady who was part of Queen Elizabeth's, one of the ladies of the court, supposed to be chaste. And he got him into a lot of trouble. Vavasor, Anne Vavasor. So he had a passionate affair with her from when she was very young. So that was adulterous, an adulterous affair, which, as I said, his forehead is branded with this forbidden love. And he then gets into a duel with the uncle of Bulbasaur, that's the Dark Lady of the Sonnets, who wounds him. So he's got a wounded leg. And then finally, in the 1590s, he does get happily married. So a court beauty, another court beauty, and her brother is a lawyer and rescues all of De Vere's finances because he's no good financially. And he has a happy last decade of his life in Nunzen, in what's called the King's Place in Hackney. And the great masterpieces flow out during that last decade when he's just quietly removed from court. He's no longer dancing around the court, and he was a great jeweler and did jousting and all this sort of exciting stuff. But he was retired and walked around his garden and finished off the great plays. So he has a quiet last decade, which I think fits in with his life.
And I love this part about the dedication of the first folio to his daughters, to men who were related to his daughters.
Yeah, yeah. That's, don't forget, he's dead. He's long dead by now. And so there's a whole lot of mysterious stuff going on that we don't know about. These two earls became immensely powerful and influential. And the Earl of Montgomery, the Lord Chamberlain, could totally control what was published. You could not publish stuff in Tudor England if they didn't want you to publish it. And so being in that position meant that he could ensure that these plays were published, right? So you get the three daughters of De Vere. This is a central clue to the authorship of the works. Elizabeth, Bridget and Susan De Vere, these characters to whom the works are dedicated, get engaged or married to these. Right.
Stunning.
Okay, now here's a very mysterious paper. A lot of people who wrongly thought that Francis Bacon had written them. He had this very upper crust building on the Strand, a very posh area of London, Sir Francis Bacon. He was a lawyer, a top lawyer in the country. He could be quite cruel and dishonest, and he could put people on the racks, which is quite in vogue those days, quite common. People would be tortured on the rack to confess stuff. So Bacon would do that. Now, here's a large manuscript called the Northumberland Manuscript. That's just the house where it was found, which has got at the top Francis Bacon, named Francis Bacon, okay, and quotes from his essays. The titles of his essays are Francis Bacon, right? And then all sorts of things he scribbled out, and it goes at the bottom to William Shakespeare. Keeps writing out William Shakespeare and quotes, one or two quotes from William Shakespeare. So people have used this. What this conclusively shows is a connection of the plays with Francis Bacon, and it absolutely rules out any Stratford authorship. There's no possibility of a guy from Stratford having plays and giving them to Francis Bacon. Okay? Sorry, just go back a minute.
Sure.
I would say, on the back of that manuscript, it says, print this text. So this was a folder that's been written on, and presumably inside it, things were kept. For example, the plays of Shakespeare, or possibly even essays of Bacon, and the instruction on the back, print this text. So obviously Bacon was instrumental in getting the Shakespeare plays published. Also, there must have been a lot of other literary involvement. He might have polished them up, you know. He might have been involved in polishing them up. Don't forget, De Vere is long dead now, many years after Edward De Vere has passed away. Bacon would presumably have been some sort of help getting the plays he'd lost his job then. He was the Lord Chancellor. He'd been retired in disgrace. But he's a great British philosopher, kind of very kind of materialistic, and he became respected by the new science. When the new science developed late in the 17th century, Bacon was quoting a lot, but it had no poetry in him at all, I suggest. Okay? Right. Okay, here are the historically main candidates, Francis Bacon, and Marlowe, and Edward Revere, and William Stanley also. So you want to choose one of those. Basically, it's connected with the glorious Elizabethan age, and that ends 1603 when she dies. Okay? Okay, next.
Here we have the 17th.
Lovely picture of De Vere, by the way. I think that is the best picture of Edward De Vere. You can see he's wearing a very theatrical type of coat, as you might expect from the director of a theatre company. And this guy is clearly the boss. He's in charge of the players. That's pretty obvious, isn't it? He's not one of the actors. That's what people have so wrongly believed for four centuries, that the author of the plays was one of the actors in a theatre company. He wasn't an actor, he was the boss, right? This is what somebody says of him, the best for comedy amongst us. So English dramatists, 1598, well, De Vere was still alive, but he was appreciated best for comedy. That's almost the only direct quote you've got that he wrote poetry. Sorry, that he wrote plays, yeah.
Excellent.
Okay, well, this is where he retires to, the last decade of his life. No longer exists. It's quite near to where I live, actually. So I've sort of gone over there and tried to get the people happily interested, but in vain.
But okay. Probably not. Not with much success, right?
No,
right. Oh, God, Nick. You made this point before about how many were based on Italian life. I find that so powerful in substantiation that it was De Vere who was the primary author of the plays. Just wonderful.
Yeah, right. So it's somebody very upper crust, very much like the royalty, and he knows the Italian geography like the back of his hand. That is who it has to be, right?
And we have more on the dark lady.
So there's no pictures of her, but
we don't have any pictures of her. I'd love to see what she looked like.
Well,
Anna Vavasor.
I don't think there are. So here he says it's got a bad reputation. Vulgar scandal stamped upon my brow. There you go, right?
Very, very nice. And then that's a Shakespearean piece right there, the literary.
Part of the sonnets. Yeah.
Yeah. Very nice.
Right.
And you're back to Hamlet, as you say, about the personal details.
Yeah. This is 1603. It starts off by saying, as it's been acted by various people in the City of London and in Oxford, Cambridge, later on, it's brought some more details that the King's ambassador has brought back from Denmark. So whoever the author was, the author has to be able to talk with the King's ambassador who comes back from Denmark, because there's very details. And then the name Polonius then appears in the 1604 edition. And this is the lament in Hamlet, which a lot of people feel applies to De Vere. Oh God, Horatio, what a wounded name! Things standing thus unknown shall live behind me. So,
meaning especially his authorship of the plays.
Yeah, but he's lost his name and associated with a scandal, and is practically bankrupt. Anyway, as we're rather short of pictures of De Vere, here's one of his son, Henry De Vere. So that might give you an idea what he looks like.
There's Stanley now.
These are William Stanley. It might not be him, not too sure. But he's got real royal blood, just as good a claim as the Queen of England. 707th. There's a Frenchman reported that he was busy in penning comedies for the common players. So that's a Frenchman who reported that. In the court of Navarre. The latest plays, like Tempest, also Midsummer Night's Dream, might have been composed by him. He's got a good claim to do the latest plays. He lived out in the West Country.
And here may be the final resting place of De Vere.
Maybe, yeah. It's still quite moody. I live quite near there. So, but there's obviously no grave silence at the De Vere.
I don't like, look at this, King Lear, own nothing and be happy. That sounds like something we're hearing from the World Economic Forum.
Yeah, right. Well, I thought that's basically what King Lear thought he could do, you know. He discovers that it's not so great after all. So that's his, as it were, final tragedy, yeah. Okay, here's somebody playing a tribute to him. Edmund Spenser. This is some classic Elizabethan text, the Fairy Queen. He's talking about Eldred de Vere. The antique glory of thine ancestry under a shady veil is therein writ. Now, that means it's concealed, right?
Yes.
What is right is concealed, under a shady veil. Thine own long-living memory succeeding true nobility. A love which thou dost bear to the Heliconian nymphs. These are supposed to be inspiring literature, right? A poetry, the Heliconian nymphs. And they to thee, they unto thee, and thou to them most dear. So these beings who inspired poets were most dear to Edward de Vere. That's what he says. Okay?
Nick, we got a break, and then we come back, and we'll open the lines for callers, but we want to review this tribute. We'll be right back with Nick Kohlerstrom, but we'll also be taking your calls.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Revolution Radio, every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, on Studio B for Momentary Zen, with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job, that Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, here we are heading into the home stretch with Nick Holerstrom. Yes, Nick, we have a final segment of 30 minutes. I know you've got a call you're handling here. So, Nick,
Okay, sweetheart. Come on. Thanks so much. Yeah.
Nick, very good. We have this tribute from, is it Chapman? Yeah, George Chapman to the 26-year-old De Vere. I mean, he was very much of a young man then, though I think, relatively speaking, the average life expectancy was less than it is now. But this still seemed like quite a commendation for a 26-year-old that he's great accomplishments. You want to tell it?
Let's get a picture of who the bard was. But nowadays, you tend to think, oh, he's so learned. He was some scholar who just spent his time reading books, okay? This was a courtier. Now, the figure of the courtier vanished from our culture several centuries ago, and it wasn't just learned, but it was he had valor, and that means he would be involved in dueling and able to maintain his reputation, sword fighting, and knowing his place in society. So I think this is a good picture of somebody perceived De Vere as a noble character. Okay, I'll just read it. So this is on his way back from Italy, okay? I overtook, coming from Italy in Germany, a great and famous Earl of England, the most goodly fashioned man I ever saw, from head to foot in form, rare and most absolute. He had a face like one of the most ancient honoured Romans, from whence his noblest family was derived. He was besides of spirit passing great, valiant and learned, and liberal as the sun, spoke and writ sweetly, or of learned subjects, or of the discipline of public weals, and 'twas the Earl of Oxford.
I love that. That's wonderful, Mac. I want to go back to that earlier. I think this is sensational, Nick. I just love this.
yeah. It's a confident fella, and he kind of lost his reputation. It has seen that his finances went to pieces, and he's had scandalous affairs. But the point is that he was totally supporting the development of theatre in England, which the Puritans were furiously against. Okay, the Puritans said this is the road to hell, you know, the theatre, and stopped.
Yeah,
well, he was totally supporting the theatre.
Yes,
and that's why we need to try and rescue his name for the great stuff he did.
Yes,
so this is a modern author talking about the European Renaissance. And how Shakespeare, as it were, opened up a whole new culture And it was a brilliant flowering of the English language. And it was no longer centrally about religion. That's the thing. People were sick and tired of religious wars. So it was a bit pagan, merrymaking, and how to have fun and enjoy evenings, why people flocked to the theatres, urgently hear what was going on. So that's the context within which we see the blossoming of these new plays. Right.
Nick, I am so impressed. I think you have really nailed it. I think you really have given so much substance.
Right.
The Earl of Oxford is the primary author of Shakespeare's works. I think you've made it beyond a reasonable doubt, my friend. That's my take.
Right. Well, anyone who likes, you like the book, give me an Amazon review. You know, that's the way to help an author. I think it's something everybody likes to talk about. This is a subject. It's not so dark as other conspiracy things are. We all need to, you know, have fun talking about it.
Let me put out that phone number, 540-352-4452. 540-352-4452. Nick and I, of course, have been talking about a wide range of issues, including what's going on in Israel with Hamas and the slaughter of the Palestinians. We've also discussed the Holocaust, the myth of the Holocaust, the fabrication of a justification for victimhood by the Jews, which has now worn out its usefulness. I think never again can they successfully play that after undertaking the genocide of the Palestinian people for now 45 days or more, Nick, and it's all been visible on television. We've been watching it day by day, the slaughter, the mayhem, the murder of innocent women, children, the elderly, the attacks on churches, on hospitals, on mosques, I mean, and ongoing too, and in the West Bank. They've given the settlers, who are fanatics, extreme fanatics, machine guns to shoot up the remaining Palestinians. They poisoned their wells. They've stolen their homes. They've ripped up their olive groves. Nick, this is just unbelievable, taking place in 2023 in the eyes of the whole world.
Anyway, let's see if we've got any viewers' comments or questions.
Well, I think, you know, I've found sometimes when you have a show that's utterly fascinating that they just want to hear more from you, from me. And I love what you have done here, Nick. I think this is absolutely fabulous.
Well, I think there could be a new interest. Enjoy perusing Shakespeare plays once you have a picture of the context in which they were composed, you know?
Yes. Well, we do have a caller. He's a frequent caller. Brian, Leon, give us your thoughts.
Well, it's interesting because we have here in Kansas City something called the Church of Saint Germain. I think it's the only one in the world, and they used to have programs every Wednesday at 10 o'clock, and they said that they really had to go underground because and not do a lot of work because George Bush Sr., their leadership was hit by all these energy weapons and heart attack guns and, you know, cancer causing, and it really decimated them. But they always had it.
Whoa, did I wait too long? I must have been one of them Mondays. Welcome one and all. Hope y'all are doing well. Today is one of those days, just crazy days. Yep. Just up too late. Yep, woke up too late. That's all right. Goose got fed, so at least that's good. didn't even have time to put my teeth in. That's all right. Welcome one and all to freedomslips.org, revolution.radio. On this 20th day of November. Wait a minute. What do you mean service isn't available? Rumble's not available? Well, that sucks. That really sucks. We are listener supported, so please, people, do us that favor. Look us up. Show us that you love us, won't you please? Okay. What? Oh, did I really? Uh-oh.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hands of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me,
give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given rights, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at...